You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe, New Mexican, and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Funding learning initiatives and community programs, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lanham Foundation for support of the Radio Cafe. The Radio Cafe is brought to you by the Santa Fe Institute, a world-renowned research hub offering free online courses in the science of complex systems. Check out their community lecture series and summer science festival in Santa Fe. More at santafe.edu. I'm delighted to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Jack Leffler. He's an award-winning author, he's a radio producer, and oral historian. His latest book is called Headed Into the Wind. It is published by the University of New Mexico Press. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be with you.
It's great to be with you, too. And here we are, fellow radio producers, but you are an author of many books, and we've talked about many of them on this program over the years. This one, we have kind of the delight of seeing your life. You're not just writing about other people and the land, but you're writing about, for example, your own childhood in West Virginia, which seems to have been quite happy, and you grew up playing jazz and reading lots of books. And as a young man, you went into the Army, and one of the first things that you describe in the book is a life-changing event that happened in 1957.
Yes, indeedy. We were in the 433rd Army Band, a bunch of jazz musicians actually drafted into the United States Army who fortunately went into a band rather than into the front lines, although in those days it was between one of the rare moments in American history when we were really between wars. But at any rate, one July morn, we were stationed in a very hot barracks and had a very hot meal and spent a very hot night. And then the next morning at 4 a.m. in Nevada, we all got into band formation, wearing our Frank Buck outfits with pith helmet and all of that stuff, shorts. It was summer in the Nevada desert. And we were playing the Stars and Stripes Forever, and all of a sudden, 7 miles away, off went an atomic bomb, and that just blew my mind completely. Totally rearranged my psychological coordinates for the rest of my life, and I decided right then and there that I would follow my own trail through this wonderful existence and not succumb to a status quo that seemed to me to be totally awry as far as cultural perspective was concerned.
Did you see the whole thing, the mushroom cloud?
Oh, yeah. At one point, just imagine this. You're standing there looking at a good 60-degree angle at the top of the mushroom cloud. What was so bizarre was that there was a very low range of hills between the band and the point of detonation, and we didn't hear a thing, but just this huge burst of light that was far brighter than the sun there for a few instants, and then an array of colors that I've never seen otherwise in nature. That was what was surprising to me.
And so there was like a strange, crazy beauty to it, and you knew instantly that everything around it was dead.
Yes, absolutely everything, including who knows how deeply into the ground it went. And I was really bemoaning the fact that some of the guys that I'd gone through basic training with were actually out there in foxholes and trenches not that far away from Point Zero. And the upshot is that had I not been in the band, I'd have been out there too. And a lot of those guys are dead now.
From cancers?
Radiation, yeah.
Yeah. So you then set off on a life of adventure. I mean, there was something about that event. And of course, you know, your life up until that event. But it seems like it was very freeing for you. And you sort of said to yourself, okay, this stuff is insane. What am I going to do to further life and not death? And so you started doing things like traveling, and you lived outdoors and in nature as much as possible. And at a certain point, you found yourself in the Navajo Nation, where you were welcomed and moved into a hogan, a little, what do you call that, like a little house,
yeah,
with your wife. What were some of the highlights of your time there?
Well, gee whiz. Some of the highlights were, the biggest highlight of all was where I came to understand that the Navajo people with whom I was living, none of whom spoke English except this one 12-year-old boy, really had been shaped by their habitat. That was something that was so totally apparent to me. And even their skin hues matched the color of the Red Rock Desert of the northern Colorado Plateau. Navajo Mountain is the most remote part of the Navajo Reservation. Thus, even today, it was, in those days, 57 miles of really funky two-track dirt road, and you really had to watch yourself driving it. But the upshot is that the family itself, there were five daughters, plus Maggie and Eugene Holgate. They were the parents, and Navajo people are matrilineal society, and so Maggie was the honcha, so to speak, the big boss. And over time, I learned so much about their perspective, even though I didn't understand the language. One of the funniest things was that at one point, Maggie Holgate appointed one of her sons-in-law to be my teacher of the Navajo language.
How'd that go?
Well, that was an interesting... The first thing that I had been reading Clyde Cluckhone, where he said that mothers-in-law and sons-in-law in Navajo culture don't talk to each other, which was wrong. That's when I started to challenge the whole notion of anthropology and what was written in books about that sort of stuff.
Because so many people are telling lies to the anthropologists.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. But the upshot was is that this guy came over, you know, a couple, three times a week, and I would struggle with the Navajo language. I'm not linguistically gifted like some people are anyway, but that's a tough language. It's so tough that it was used during World War II by the code talkers. But the upshot is that the ladies' club, as I referred to them, Maggie and the daughters would come over once a week and sit on the sheepskins on the floor of the hogan, which is just a little wood and mud enclosure. Some great digs, really, but they would listen to me murder Navajo and roll around on the floor laughing with tears streaming down their face. And it was about easing into the third week, and they were sitting there watching. If you can watch vigorously, they were watching vigorously. And my teacher and I were trying to talk, and all of a sudden I snapped to the fact that my teacher had a speech impediment. And they saw me understand that, and then they totally cracked up. And then I totally cracked up, and we were all rolling around on the hogan floor. It was just a total delight. But that that was the end of my any attempt whatsoever to try to learn the Navajo language. Although I was offered a job out there by Miles Hedrick, who was then the proprietor of the Rainbow Lodge Trading Post. He and Barry Goldwater were partners in that venture. And Miles asked me if I would become his trader. He would teach me the whole business of trading, but somehow the idea of trying to bargain down Navajo people on their jewelry and sheepskins could not work for me, and so I declined.
But there were some, I mean, you didn't speak the language, but there were some real nonverbal events that happened, and one of them was where you were outside of your little house and a medicine man came walking toward you very intentionally. What happened?
Well, that basically, Eugene Holgate, who was married to Maggie, the matriarch, had what they call a squaw dance, which is an enemy way ceremony, and I always hoped that I wasn't the enemy in that. But the upshot is that this whole thing took place in Kaipato, maybe 30 miles away, and all of us had collected in Kaipato, and I'd parked my pickup truck filled with goats and sheep for the fiesta. And I had nosed into a hogan, so I couldn't back out very readily. And I was sitting there listening, and I could hear drumming and chanting from within the medicine hogan, which was not that very far away, maybe 40, 50 feet away from me. And then all of a sudden, the door of that hogan, all hogans face east, the doorways face east to greet the sun. The door flew open, and all of these old men, including Eugene Holgate, came flying out the door, each waving a skein of yarn. And all but Eugene had a specific color, like red or whatever. And Eugene had a multicolored skein of yarn, and they all jumped on their horses and rode away, yipping and carrying on, and it was really amazing. And then there was silence, broken by a very light drum beat on the water drum. And there emerged through the Hogan door the medicine man, the Hatale, who had performed the ceremony. And little by little, he was walking toward me, and on every second step, you'd hear a drum beat, thump. And he kept coming toward me, and his eyes were locked on my eyes. And I thought, this is getting very weird. And so I drew an imaginary line about 4 feet in front of me, and I forbade him in my mind to cross that line. And by golly, he stopped right there, and he looked at me, and he beat the drum one more time, and then he grinned and stuck out his hand and said, "Yate." And I said, "Yate." And we rolled up a couple of smokes and smoked, and then the women brought over some blood sausage. But by the way, when that moment happened after the men had left the Hogan, nobody else was around at all. There had been a scurry of activity with ladies and kids and everybody doing what they did. But that really impressed me. And from that moment on, I felt totally welcome at Navajo Mountain.
It was kind of a test, but you didn't really know what was being tested exactly.
Nope, I did not. And there I was. And I feel like I passed the test, because thereafter everything was fine. And I realized then that I didn't think that I was the enemy. And that night there was a big squaw dance. That's the big deal after the thing. And we all went, this was at a totally different place where there was a big bonfire and people had their drums and sang all sorts of songs and danced the squaw dance. And it was really great.
So that was one chapter of your young life, your 20-something life. And another piece that was really influential, and it's really striking to me how many writers do this. You were a fire lookout.
Yes, that was, boy, oh boy. After the living in the Hogan, we went back to Berkeley and spent the winter there because we had to. And that early in the spring, or even late in the winter, I wrote letters to 35 ranger districts throughout the North American Southwest. I'd heard of what the job was from some friends that I'd met in Taos, but I'd never even met a fire lookout. But I thought, boy, that sounds like a great way to spend time. And by golly, I got 6 responses from 6 different ranger districts that year. And one of them was the Jicarilla Ranger District of the Carson National Forest in the northwestern corner of New Mexico, where I'd passed through the year before on my way up to Navajo Mountain and had a sort of a quasi-mystical experience with a turkey feather. And that was obviously, to me, the place to take the fire lookout. Well, it turned out it was regarded in those days, this is 1965, wow, a long time ago, over half a century ago, but in those days it was regarded as the most primitive fire lookout in the whole U.S. Forest Service. No tower, no nothing. You were just up there on about a 2.5-acre slab of Navajo sandstone. And so got there, set up camp. It was too soon to have yet gotten my Osborne firefinder, so what I had was a map, a USGS map, a handheld surveyor's compass, and a pair of binoculars and a shortwave radio with a lot of batteries. And that was it. And I'd walk around that rock many times a day, looking into the deep canyons and wherever I could, looking for fires. And I just didn't see many. Of course, I started pretty early on. That year we started April 12th, and it's about 100 days and nights a year, at least it was then. And it was just being camped out there in the middle of this wonderful, ostensibly a wilderness area. It was a national forest, but in those days nothing was happening, or at least to my knowledge. And after a few days just settled into this place, and it felt so at home that I realized that nature really is our home. The flow of nature is what's really happening. And to the extent that, you know, when it was time to leave the fire lookout, I wept because I didn't want to leave. I wanted to just stay there. I did not want to return to this strange culture that was celebrating things that I had zero interest in.
Many people in your position would have been bored out of their skulls.
Not I. We always took books, took many books. I remember one year, I think it was 1966. Yes, it was. Took the collected works, or many of the collected works, of Carl Jung on that fire lookout, plus some novels, and got up there, and I read, and I read, and I read. I realized that that happened to be in 1966, because on the eve of my 30th birthday, which was July 11th, 1966, I had this dream, and I was visited by both Carl Jung and Albert Einstein.
Nice.
And they told me that I had an ICPED personality, which I have yet to decipher.
Does that mean you had icky feet?
I think it meant I had a fish foot. It was strange. But at any rate, Jung and Einstein, the two of them, and it was really, and then they got into a dialogue about something else in my dream. But it was a powerful dream for me. So that moment in time, I have to say that the work of Carl Jung really did affect me. I was also into meditation by then. I had been for a long time. But, you know, and I read other books that had to do with that. But that was an important time for me.
Well, one of the things about being in the flow of nature and it really affecting your consciousness, as well as the things you were reading, is illustrated by the fact, and the extent to which you were changed and really became part of nature was illustrated by the fact that at a certain point you saw a rattlesnake and you knew what to do and you weren't scared and you both survived.
Oh, it was terrific. This was deep into that season. And the thing is, Mary Charlotte, when you're into it, you become totally harmonious with everything that's around you. And yes, you have to be wary. And one evening, I had gone off the top of the rock down into the woods to gather some firewood to build a fire. And I was doing exactly what the Boy Scouts taught me not to do, which is to bend over and pick up firewood indiscriminately. And by golly, I had my hand about a foot away from the open maw of a rattlesnake, and it started hissing and rattling at me. And I thought, gee whiz. And so I held that position for a while. I didn't feel any fear. I felt like this is what's happening. This is the way it is now in this moment in time. It makes you in very much a part of the present, let me put that.
Yeah.
And so I crouched there, and I was getting really uncomfortable after a few minutes because I had under my left arm, I had a whole bunch of firewood, and my right arm was out like this, and I was crouched. And so I slowly crouched down so that I could squat on my heels, left my hand out there, and after a while the snake stopped hissing and then it stopped rattling, but its tongue was flicking in and out.
Was its mouth still open?
Well, after it had quit hissing, it closed the mouth.
Okay.
But they're so fast. But little by little, I looked into that snake's eyes and I could see it somehow. We got into each other's heads is what it boiled down to. And then after a few more minutes, I started to hear thunder and realized I had to get back up on top of the rock to look for lightning strikes and log them to see if I could spot smokes. So I very slowly withdrew my hand, and I very slowly stood up, and I looked down at the rattler and thanked it for not having bitten me. And I turned and I started walking back up to the lookout, and by golly, I looked down and the snake was following me. We had really gotten into each other in a big way. And so I stopped again, and this is about halfway up from where we were. I said to the snake, you know, we really do have to part company now, but this has really been great. Thank you. And the snake and I headed in our...
And so we turned around?
Yeah.
You've also, I mean, later you got into audio recording, wildlife recording and music and all kinds of things, and you recorded a rattlesnake.
Yes, I did. That was another rattler. Boy, that was down in the Sonoran Desert. This was probably around 1990 or thereabouts. And I was working on a project for Oregon Pipe Cactus National Monument, and I'd been camped down in the Kuyokach Wash all by myself for a while, 5 or 8 days. And there's nothing like that, being totally alone in the middle of a desert. And you're hearing all of this wildlife and recording it. But at one point, I had my recorder, and I had a microphone and a windscreen, a shotgun mic, about yay. And I was walking along, and I'd spotted a Gila woodpecker on top of a sahuaro. And I was busy focusing on the Gila woodpecker and trying to get in a good position to get the best possible sound. And all of a sudden, I looked down, or I didn't all of a sudden, I just looked down to make sure I wasn't going to trip over something. And there, right smack in front of me, was a big old diamondback. And I thought, this is too good to miss.
It was. And just you said, I know your cousin.
Just about. Well, by this time, I mean, that rattlesnake experience in the Jicarilla country really made me understand that all of these fellow creatures, which we see as alien, are not alien. They're all kindred, really, even the plants. And I'll get into that in a sec. But the upshot was, I looked at the snake and I thought, boy, this would be a great recording if he's amenable or she's amenable. I couldn't tell whether it were male or female. But whatever it was stretched out in front of me, warming up in the the early morning sun. And so I goosed it with the front of my microphone, and it coiled and started to hiss. And I put the front of the microphone right in front of its hissing mouth, and it hissed and hissed and hissed and rattled and rattled and rattled. And then I slowly withdrew the microphone. It was, my hand was about a foot away, but I pulled my hand away, and the snake stopped hissing and then finally stopped rattling. And again, I thanked the snake for not biting me. But it was one of the great recordings I've ever gotten. And I listen to that sometimes because it brings me back in tune with things that I need to be in tune with. And I think we all need to be in tune with. Good rattlesnake.
All of the things you're talking about can be thought of as really explorations in consciousness and adventures in consciousness. I mean, you know, you see the atomic bomb and you're a fire lookout and you live in Navajo country and you live under the stars. It seems like you're sleeping outdoors as much as you're sleeping indoors, if not more. And you also experimented with drugs like peyote, and you described that expanding your consciousness as well.
That was one of the most amazing. I took peyote, I think, a total of 18 times. And one time in particular, at a place called Pyramid Lake, which is north of Reno, probably the most primordial landscape I've ever visited. There are these amazing rock formations, and Pyramid Lake is part of one of the Indian reservations, Paiute Reservation. And the north end of the lake is a place where there's a cave. And several of us who were sort of part of a beatnik phase of getting into a psychedelic situation had gone to this cave to have meetings. This started around 1960 or 61, our own version of a peyote meeting. But I liked to go out there by myself sometimes. And at one point, I was there and I had peyote and I fasted for 3 days. And on the morning of the fourth day, I took peyote. And that event still is big time in my mind because I saw that everything was alive, everything was totally interconnected, that the planet was an entity that had a consciousness of its own and was communicating with me big time. I realized that the peyote was a doorway into this consciousness. At that moment in time, I also wondered what was happening to the consciousness of the peyote, having taken me into its mind, which was an interesting thought. But it was a collaborative moment between the peyote and me and the planet. And I realized what a sacred place we live on. And that experience, it's still there with me. I didn't mention this in the book, but at one point I had met with a couple of other friends of mine to see if we could pick a day to see if we could contact each other consciously. One was Michael Harner, who was a great proponent of shamanism, and the other was Richard Alpert, who then became Baba Ram Dass. And neither, we never connected consciously on that moment. It was, for me, it was totally getting into the place and realizing that. And that stayed with me through the very, to today. I mean, that's really important to me. I don't need to take any other substances whatsoever. That's the kind of consciousness that I was always hoping for. You know, starting even in high school with meditation, I started on that just to try to change the subject from high school, which I did not like one iota.
You're not a school kind of guy.
Oh, no. No, I dropped out of college, and that's the best thing I ever did to myself, because that way I was in charge of the directing of my own consciousness rather than having somebody else tell me what to do.
Well, and so what you ended up doing was putting so many things together. I mean, you're talking about this consciousness of the complete integration of all life. You're talking about the looking out at the forests for fire, which is integrated into, I mean, adapted into those landscapes. And in fact, I was going to ask you, when you're a fire lookout, looking back on that, I mean, the forests that you were looking out on, that particular forest, was, as all the forests in the Southwest are, or in the West are, adapted to fire. Were they doing that overly aggressive fire management in a way that ended up not being good for the landscape?
Yes, that's a very good question. The upshot is that, well, the reason for the firefighting, from the point of view of the Forest Service, at least at that particular moment in time, was to not let the trees burn down so they could be cut down and sold. And I wasn't quite aware of this until later on in my career, such as it was as a fire lookout. And part of my job was to be the initial attack on any fire that I spotted that was close enough at hand. And I did fight, you know, 12, 15 fires over the course of the 3 years that I was a lookout. But basically, fire is a part of the flow of nature. But when you let the fires be put out, the undergrowth doesn't burn up like it should. And subsequently, when lightning strikes something that hasn't been, that has just continued to grow and grow and grow over a period of 50, 60, 80, 100 years, that's when you have these massive forest fires like we're experiencing right now in California.
So you were inadvertently part of that fire mismanagement regime, which we're still dealing with today. But getting back to this whole question of consciousness, so indigenous consciousness, sort of the consciousness of the earth itself, of that biology, mythological consciousness, Joseph Campbell and all of those things, and you ended up integrating all of those things. And part of what you spent your life, very large parts of your life doing, was recording both the music and the stories of indigenous people and Hispanic people in the American Southwest. And as you said before, with the Navajos, but also with Hispanic New Mexicans and the music, there's such a connection between their music and the land.
That is so true. I have recorded, well, to me, the Hispanos of Nuevo Mexico are indigenous here. I mean, after a good 20 generations, that accounts for some major rootedness in place. And many of the Hispanos have also, well, there's been a cultural mestizaje, a mixture of cultures between a lot of the Native Americans who live in the northern Rio Grande and outskirts of the, and with the Hispano people. And so it's a new raza, new race here. But the Native American peoples that we think of as Indians, wrongly named Indians, but many of them call themselves Indians as well because that's what's happening now. But the upshot is I've visited with people as far north as the Nez Perce of the Clearwater watershed up in Idaho, all the way down into the Usumacinta watershed of southern Chiapas, and visited and spent a lot of time, many, probably years of my life, actually, either camped with, living with, or otherwise associated with these Native American people. And they've all opened up to me. And I think they sense that I'm not going to try to give them the royal shaft, as has happened so frequently with our group, our species on this continent.
Well, the sort of colonial mentality.
Yeah, and I don't have that mentality at all. And that has been sensed by a lot of these people. But the upshot is that one of the biggest things that I've taken away from all of this is that I have never, ever interviewed an Indigenous person who is still within the context of their cultural tradition, who does not regard the landscape as sacred, whereas our culture has secularized habitat for the purpose of basically turning it into money. And this is a huge disparity, and it prevails to such an extent in today's American culture, to the extent that it's actually subsuming a lot of the cultural attitudes of many of the younger Native American peoples. And this, to me, is a huge sad, it's more than a sadness. It could become the greatest of all tragedies, because we're closing down a doorway that we need to desperately leave open so that we can perceive that the flow of nature is where the action is. The other day I had this thought, time is the flow of nature through the universe. And that really has stuck in my head these last few days, because the Native American people understand this intuitively, intrinsically, whereas our culture has forgotten this. And so much of global culture, especially since the end of World War II, has been so, again, subsumed by a new paradigm which is founded in economics that actually started back with the Industrial Revolution of, say, 300 years ago or so. This is wiping our intuitive abilities away from the real bigger picture that I think that if we fail to address this, we're doomed as a species. In other words, we have to reinvigorate our intuitions as to our place in nature. And this is one of the huge lessons that the Native American people have to teach us, and all Indigenous peoples, not just here, but everywhere. And I've run into this with the Hispano people as well. I've run into this with some ranchers as well. I've many friends who are ranchers who really understand themselves as part of the flow of nature. It's not just about making money off the cattle. And these are people whose perspectives and friendship I truly value, because I feel that the relationship that could grow, if it's allowed to, could really save us. And so that's what I've done in my own life throughout the American Southwest. I regard this as the region, and that includes northwestern Mexico. This is the region in which I've really decided to spend my life and really try to understand as best I could. I have many scientist friends who also understand this intuitively. My very close friend, whom you also know, Gary Paul Nabhan, understands this totally intuitively, and this caused him to actually go after an advanced degree in ethnobotany, and he's become one of our foremost thinkers. But he also understands it on the intuitive level, that indeed the planet is a sacred place, and we have to understand that we are part of it. We are part of the planet's consciousness.
One of the points that you make that I think is very important is that there's no one way of thinking that should be preeminent over the others. So, for example, if we devote our lives entirely to being economic units in a system, then we are economic beings first and foremost and totally, and that is basically a death sentence for the very nature from which we evolved and that supports us. But if you also say that nature is entirely sacred and every bit of it should be preserved, then where's the food going to be produced? And so there has to be a balance. And when you talk about these ranchers, some of them are making money and preserving the land. And so there's a kind of like, how do we have an economic reality that gives us the things we need on a planet full of lots of people and have a kind of consciousness of the sacredness of the earth and the water?
Well, that's a really good issue. I really started getting into that particular issue. I'd read The Tragedy of the Commons by Garrett Hardin back in 1970. I became very much an active environmentalist for some time, still remain that way in my own way. But in 1984, I happened to be in Santa Barbara, and I looked up Garrett Hardin in the phone book, and by golly, there he was. And so I went out to his house at his invitation and set up my recording equipment and recorded a wonderful interview with Garrett Hardin, where I first asked him to talk about his essay that had affected so many of us in those days and still continues to do.
The Tragedy of the Commons. And just very briefly explain that to our listeners.
What Hardin had done was take a common pasture land that took place in late 17th, 18th century Britain, where people who were living in the region were putting their cattle, their pigs, their sheep, their goats, their cows into a common pasture land. And it was working fine and worked that well for centuries, basically. And then it became apparent that the commons was becoming overpopulated. There were getting to be too many cattle out there, too many chattel out there grazing, and that if they put too many more out there, the commons would crash. It would fail as an ecosystem. But they did, and it did. The commons crashed from overpopulation of cattle. And what Hardin said to me, which to me was a very profound insight, that he regarded that as a tragedy because the people knew that it was going to crash in advance, but they did it anyway, just like we're doing today. And so that essay has profound effect on my mind and that interview with him. And then he brought up a person who had affected his own thinking, a man named William Ophuls, O-P-H-U-L-S, who had coined the apothem, "Nature abhors a maximum."
Yes, I thought that was such an interesting concept.
Yeah, what that means is that if you maximize a whole fiscal relationship with habitat to the extent that you're mining natural resources to the extent that that's the only thing that you have in mind in order to increase wealth, basically, you're minimizing the flow of nature. You're minimizing your understanding of the natural flow of things to the extent that the commons itself will crash yet again. And so that's what Ophuls was talking about, and that's what Hardin was talking about. And that put me into a mode that I'm still in, trying to understand the nature of the commons. And to me, it's a lot bigger than a cow pasture in Britain. It's the whole planet.
Yeah, for example, the oceans.
The oceans, the air, the atmosphere, the entire landscape. But one of the things that has come full circle to me since that wonderful conversation with Garrett Hardin, he remained a friend until he died, actually. I liked him. We would eat strawberries together off and on over the years. And subsequently, I interviewed a woman who took some umbrage with part of what he had to say, a woman named Eleanor Ostrom, who'd gotten the 2009 Nobel for her book Governing the Commons. And she said at no point in Garrett Hardin's entire genre, his oeuvre of writing, she said he never once mentioned the word trust, which was an interesting thing. And so she had gotten involved in game theory and trying to bring in the notion of trust when dealing with governing the commons. And she said that that has had an amazing effect. And so between that and then finally interviewing my friend Gerrymander, who had written The Capitalism Papers, Fatal Flaws of an Obsolete System earlier on, the book he's probably best known for, is Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television. But Gerry pointed out...
Lots of luck.
Oh, boy. No, I mean, he saw something there so profoundly, basically. But Gerry had pointed out that immediately, well, before the end of World War II, the nations who had been the Allied powers got together in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, in order to formulate what would become the global economy and the World Bank. And that captivated everybody's consciousness, especially in context with looking at television, where advertisers advertising the corporate perspective just got into everybody's head, and we became a nation of consumers big time. And what that allowed me to see, boy, when I was talking to Gerry, it just hit me big time, that consciousness itself is a commons. Human consciousness is a commons.
Now, you talk about that in the book. Tell us more what you mean by that. I mean, I can see that a pasture is common to the people, and an ocean or a lake, you know, everybody fishes in the lake. Those are commons. Consciousness, tell us more.
Well, when you think about the fact that a culture is held in place by its system of mores, you know, the different factors that create the points of view that we have, like organized religion, organized education, organized economic perspective. All of those things are where we spend much of our conscious time on a daily basis. The news, what's happening in Washington, D.C. as we speak. And all of that stuff is what pervades our consciousness on a collective level. But what I had learned with the Native American people is what had pervaded their consciousness at least as much as economics had to us, was their sense of the sacred quality of nature and understanding that life is sacred and everything about it is sacred. And then going back in time, you know, 3.5 to 4 billion years, and discovering that we're all descended from a common ancestor, or at least that is the current thinking, that we share 355 genes with the last universal common ancestor of 3.8 billion years ago. But what that reveals is that indeed we are distant cousins of every other species that has ever lived since that time and up and into the present. And so that is a commons. Life itself is a commons that's common to the planet Earth. And part of life, according to my friend Fritjof Capra, who wrote a fabulous book, A System's View of Life, A Unifying Vision. The upshot is that Fritjof Capra had taken a huge cue from two Chilean biologists, Humberto Maturana and Francisco Varela, who had come up with the notion of autopoiesis. But the bottom line there is that every living entity has, every cell has some level of cognition. In other words, life and cognition are two components of any particular phenomenon that's alive. You know, life and cognition. Now, that doesn't mean consciousness in this at the cellular level, but some level of cognition exists. And then it goes through varying degrees as the species evolve through sentience.
Because every little cell is responding to its environment and to other cells, so they have cognition.
It's busy surviving its environment. And that's, in other words, getting sustenance and surviving. And as Stuart Brand pointed out to me very readily, when we started surviving on a certain level, reproduction and death were also concurrent phenomena. And that's when it became eukaryotic life, mitochondrial life. And that's a whole other discussion. But the upshot is that life itself is a commons, common to the planet Earth. And presumably there are other planets out there that have some form of life, but we aren't going to find that out for a while, as far as I'm concerned. But the upshot is that as cognition sprouted through the evolution of life into sentience and ultimately into different species that do have levels of consciousness, including the human species and, say, an octopus and whales and other creatures. We are not the only conscious species on this planet. We are aware on a conscious level that is not just within our own selves, but also on a whole cultural level. And so the stuff that a culture puts into the air, so to speak, becomes the collective commons, the commons of human consciousness right there. But what we've done, and this harkens back to what we were talking about, nature abhorring a maximum, is that we have maximized our interest in fiscal evolution and economics to the extent that we have sublimated an awful lot of other stuff that is absolutely vital to our continued existence on the planet. And that's where I think that these other doorways into the kind of consciousness that so many of the traditional Native American people still do experience, even though they're waning.
Yeah. So the idea nature abhors a maximum is so interesting to me, because the subtext of that seems to me to be, correct me if this is wrong, that it's not about maximizing anything, but about balancing them and balancing them pretty consciously, and maybe even doing a kind of biomimicry in the sense that, you know, nature is balancing itself in lots of different ways with lots of different feedback mechanisms all the time, and society can and should do that too.
Yes, that is so right on the button. And unless we do, in other words, we've gotten into a habit. Maybe we have incorporated into our system of mores our interest in economic development, plus the fact that we have hugely overpopulated. One of the things that I did mention in the book is that in the course of my life, the human population has increased over 350%. It's gone from about 2 billion to 7.8 billion. That is really scary. And when I talked to Garrett Hardin, it was still under 7 billion, but he was really forwarding right to the day he died that human overpopulation is one of probably the biggest factor that we have to contend with. And the reason being is that we get more numerous, and whatever it is we're doing to the habitat, according to New Scientist magazine, to which I still subscribe, by 2030, in other words, in about 10 more years, it will take two planets, the equivalent of planet Earth, to support the human population that we have today at our rate of expenditure of natural resources. And so what does this say? I mean, if I were being really cynical, I would say, let's get bumper stickers that say, pray for pandemic. But that's a very cynical thought, and I'm sorry I said that.
How about birth control?
Birth control is very important, extremely important, and conscious birth control. In other words, the genders have to come together in a mindset that is not currently as available as it should be, but I think it's getting there of late, I'm hoping. But the upshot is, in other words, I took a huge cue from Maggie Holgate, Navajo Matrilineal Society. That was a society that was working in beauty. That's their whole point, Hojro, to proceed in beauty. And their sense of beauty had to do with balance with nature.
How do you see an increasingly urban industrial society doing that? In other words, you're not going to get rid of cities. You're not going to get rid of industry. You and I, and you're very conscious of this. I mean, we're sitting here talking on recording equipment that was made with mined minerals and petroleum products and all kinds of things. And we are in the system, like it or not, and that system gives us many, many wonderful, truly wonderful benefits. So how do you kind of envision, and how are people that you're working with envisioning balance within that?
Well, this is a huge issue, and I've thought about this a lot. Actually, in my book, what I do is I juxtapose excerpts from two interviews. One was Stuart Udall, who was born in St. John's, Arizona, who grew up in a rural environment and feels that that's absolutely vital to his perspective, or he did. He's passed away now 10 years ago almost. And the other was with Stuart Brand. They knew each other back in 1964, believe it or not. And Stuart Brand contends that the urban situation is where all of the hope is. And so I look at the urban situation and I look at the rural situation, and I believe that the rural perspective is necessary somehow to get into human consciousness once again. I look at the urban areas and I see them as extremely fragile. They may look strong and healthy and vital, but earlier I mentioned pandemic. They are bullseyes for pandemic to happen within, or to have major breakdowns in the infrastructure. Urban infrastructure is really spooky to me.
And yet, as Santa Fe Institute scientist Jeff West has pointed out, and others in his group, cities last longer than countries. Cities last longer than corporations. Cities are some of the most resilient social structures we have.
Well, that's understandable, and I understand. Yeah, I read his book too, Scale. But the point is that if you have an ever-increasing human population, there comes a point of no return. In other words, we simply will not have the resources to support everything that it takes, that takes place. The human population is settling in cities, but more and more, I think it's right now, 80% of the people in America are living in urban environments. When I was a kid, I think it was more like 40 or 50%.
Yeah.
So that's the trend. And I have no idea. I can't prognosticate what's going to happen. But I do know that unless our human population really starts to go back down, who knows what's a suitable number. When I was born, it was roughly 2 billion people on the planet. And even then, China was regarded as overpopulated when I was a little boy. I remember that. I think, in a way, from a human perspective, it may be an unsolvable problem. But from the flow of nature's perspective, I think it will be solved by our species being greatly reduced. I think that our current situation with regard to global warming and climate instability are huge factors, as Stuart Brand pointed out, who, by the way, is a very brilliant man and an old pal. He was a buddy back in the, not from 1960 on.
And you quote him rather extensively in the book.
Yes, I do. And he points out that his friend, Craig Venter, who was one of the people involved in the Human Genome Project, who himself is a fantastic oceanographer, and even by going out after the Genome Project, shotgunning the seas, even in the Sargasso Sea, he's come up with more genes in that one trip than we had previously understood. But Venter had told Stuart that we are shifting very radically from an ocean-based ecosystem to a land-based ecosystem, and I can't get into the science of that because I don't understand it, but that connotes that a land-based ecosystem couldn't possibly support more than 1.5 billion humans. And we're going to get there the hard way, as Stuart pointed out. In other words, 6 billion of us or more are going to go down the hard way, and it'll be a pretty rapid decline. And so that will result in a level of chaos. And I have no idea how the urban centers are going to contend with that level of chaos. So these are the situations, whereas, as Stuart Udall pointed out, they grew their own food. And they were in a position to do that, hanging the side of beef on the north side of the house in the wintertime, that kind of thing. Those are things that indigenous-minded people understand how to do, but very few of us are that indigenous-minded. I'm sure not. We have a little garden in the summertime, and that's about it. But I don't hunt anymore. I used to. But I didn't make the rifle, nor did I make the bullets. I have a friend who has bow-hunted elk and makes fantastic jerky, but that's a rarity. In other words, at the current population rate, we're bound to crash on some level, you know, many levels. In other words, how dangerously affected can economics itself be in this kind of a situation? In other words, what would it take for the whole economic system to crash? And then what do we do? Because we have been relying on the current economic system to the extent to survive, that we have survived our way out of a system of survival that's commensurate with who we are relative to where we came from.
And although we can't know what that's going to look like, and it's awfully hard to prepare for, although the world is full of survivalists of one kind or another, it remains that expanding one's consciousness to embrace all kinds of ways of thinking and being in the world certainly can't hurt.
No, and that to me, boy, I started getting intuitions of this when I started reading Joseph Campbell way back when. He had a beautiful mind. I met him one time. I did correspond with him thereafter, but boy, what a beautiful mind. And he understood that the mythic process is a very important process. He, by the way, had been the editor of the Uranos Yarbuchen that had been sort of founded by Carl Jung. But he took the whole mythic process much further with his four-book series, The Masks of Gods. And he understood that intuition of one's place in nature was absolutely vital to survival in the bigger sense, because with that kind of consciousness, you're experiencing a level of joy that's not otherwise available. It's just the joy of being at large in the flow of nature. And so what I try to talk about, and what I try to do to this day, which I've been doing my entire, even pre-adult life to this moment in time, is to go as joyfully skinny dipping in the flow of nature as often as I can.
And maybe that's a nice place to end. Jack Loeffler is an author, radio producer, oral historian. It's spelled A-U-R-A-L. That's sort of a term that you coined. The latest book is called Headed Into the Wind, from University of New Mexico Press. So much more to talk about, but ladies and gentlemen, you'll just have to read the book. Jack, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte, for inviting me. I am honored and flattered. Thank you.
And we'd like to thank our sponsors of the Radio Cafe, the Lanel Foundation, the Lannan Foundation, Lenzic Performing Arts Center, Southwest Care, and the Santa Fe Institute. Thanks so much for making this program possible.
Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Supporting social and emotional needs of students and teachers, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lanl Foundation for supporting the Radio Cafe. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.